day, everyone, and welcome to today's American Immigration Lawyers Association telebriefing on Protection of Asylum Seekers conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask a question during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing star and one on your touchtone phone. Please note this call may be recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Greg Tenn. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Erica. Welcome to everybody who is joining us now on this teleconference about the situation in Central America and those who are coming here to the United States seeking asylum. I am Greg Chen, the Director of Advocacy with the American Immigration Lawyers Association. In a moment, I'll introduce the speakers. By way of quick introduction, we are looking at a situation now in the past several years where refugees have been fleeing an epidemic of violence that has taken over Central America, particularly in the Northern Triangle of Central America, including El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, reported last year that there was a five-fold increase in asylum requests to the U.S. from that region. And for countries in Central America nearby El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, there's been a 13-fold increase in asylum requests. Families, children, and other extremely vulnerable individuals coming to the U.S. deserve protection under our laws and should be treated humanely when they arrive. But instead of protecting them, we are seeing that U.S. immigration officials are subjecting them to aggressive enforcement tactics that are actually designed to deter them from coming. On today's press conference, we'll be addressing the nature of the violence and the conditions in the Northern Triangle that are forcing people to flee. And it is this uncontrolled and, at the same time, targeted violence that makes such a high number of these migrants who are fleeing that makes them qualify as refugees. We will also be addressing the U.S. response to the situation and the growing concern that asylum seekers are not being protected by the U.S. government. Specifically in this regard, AILA is issuing a report today at noon entitled Due Process Denied, Central Americans Seeking Asylum and Protection in the United States. For the press members on the call today, you should have gotten copies of this exactly at noon today, so I hope you have links to it in your boxes now. So with that quick introduction, I'm going to turn over to our speakers. In brief, first we'll have Congressman Luis Gutierrez, then Daniela Burgi Palomina, who is with the Latin American Working Group, and finally Ben Johnson, Executive Director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Congressman Gutierrez represents Chicago, is a Democrat from Illinois. He also sits on the House Judiciary Committee, which has jurisdiction over almost all the issues of immigration and refugees issues. He has worked on just about every major immigration bill that has come through Congress in the recent decades and has been just very concerned about the situation in Central America. In particular, I will mention on this topic that he and more than 100 other members of the House sent a letter in January to the administration expressing concern about raids actions that have been that are starting to be done this year against Central American families and children. With that, I'm going to turn over to Congressman Gutierrez. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Well, thank you, Greg. Thank you so much. Look, before we begin, I just want to note that this is the fourth anniversary of the announcement of DACA by President Obama, the Deferred Action Program for Dreamers. So 4 years ago, we started putting people who we consider assets to our communities into a safe place so they wouldn't face or have to fear deportation. You know, 750,000 young people enrolled and they're contributing to our society, and it demonstrates that we need to do more of the same. Our immigration policies should always reflect our values and emphasize inclusion, integration, and assimilation, not exclusion and deportation. And we should have a legal framework for immigrants who contribute so much to the United States that's not temporary, but a path to citizenship. The case currently before the Supreme Court in our fall election next November will determine whether DACA marked a turning point when America moved forward or whether opponents of immigration are going to take us backward. We're going to learn that pretty soon from the Supreme Court. And we're going to learn it. We're going to give it another test next November. Also, I want to note that 1 year ago, I helped lead a delegation of members of Congress to two detention centers in Texas, Zoe Laughrin, Lucille Roble-Allard, Joaquin Castro, Steny Hoyer, and several others. We went and we talked to the women and saw the conditions that they and their children were being held in. I just want to be clear. What we learned on that trip a year ago was that these women and their children were refugees. What we met were refugees. They were fleeing warlike conditions. They were fleeing violence, and they had witnessed and been threatened with violence. One woman told me and Steny Hoyer something that has stayed with me. She said, "We can live in our countries in poverty, but we cannot live in our countries in peace." Think about that. They didn't come here for economic reasons. They didn't come here looking for a job, trying to improve their economic condition. They came here seeking peace. They had to go out of where they were, and by any definition, when you have to leave where you're at, you're a refugee. They're not economic migrants. They are not immigrants. They are they're not undocumented or illegal immigrants. They're following U.S. law, turning themselves over to the mercy of the United States and seeking safety for their children. The other thing we learned is that these were jails. They might have been nice jails, but they were privately run jails. Access to the outside world was very limited. Access to counsel was very limited. And the U.S. government would rather we not know or think too much about what was happening there. I've worked very closely since then with Zoe Laughrin and Lucille Roble-Allard. And most of you know to get as many of the women and children out of those jails as possible. And I think we've done good work, and we've improved the conditions for hundreds. Whether it's a bond or an ankle bracelet or pretrial services to move their cases and get them through the process, I think we've been making progress again. But I fear we're slipping, as the attorneys and experts will point out on this call. But I think the basic U.S. strategy is flawed when it comes to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and those that are coming. Our government is making a determination that treating the women and children badly will prevent more from leaving the violence in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Treat them badly, and they'll just suffer the consequences of the violence in their country. Putting women and children in jail, making their asylum cases difficult, getting the women without lawyers or translators to the point of deportation as quickly as they can, going after children as soon as they turn 18, and then leaking the news so that the deportations are reported on Univision and Telemundo, and the word gets back to Central America. That appears to be their strategy. And fear of a lengthy court process or bad food in a jail is not a lot compared to what you went through crossing borders with criminal smugglers to get here and violence that made you leave in the first place. These are refugees to be rescued, not immigrants to be deterred. They're refugees to be rescued, not immigrants to be deterred. When refugees flee the Sudan or Syria or another war zone, we don't tell our allies, well, you guys should really do something quickly to send them all back where they came from. We say, and rightly so, that we as a community of nations, as civilized members of the human race, must help. We must help challenge the conditions that are driving the violence and the evacuation in the first place. And I do not hear enough about what the U.S. is doing to help stabilize El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And we tell other nations, and rightly so, that we must find a way to accommodate and care for refugees until they can be resettled in nations around the world. On a very basic level, I'm saying that the United States should treat this refugee crisis in our own hemisphere, in the region that we are so used to control 100% or better or for worse, through the Monroe Doctrine, and work with our allies in the region. Why not work Venezuela and Belize and Costa Rica and Mexico and Canada? Why not have a hemispheric approach to address the crisis as a crisis, a refugee crisis, I think this is the moment we need the Secretary of State, Kerry, to step up. I get it. Secretary Kerry is working hard on Syria and other big problems. But we have a big problem close that needs his attention too, real close. And if the president doesn't step up and show leadership, the knuckleheads are going to exploit these refugees for political gain. Pictures of refugees at the border, that's a story tailor-made for Trump and Breitbart and Fox News and House Republicans to exploit. Lie about and fearmonger about to scare people the way they did 2 years ago, the way politicians are doing in Britain and Europe right now. I want our country to do the right thing. Get ahead of this and lead by example as we've always done and we should do now. I want to thank everybody for allowing me to be part of this call.
Thank you so much, Congressman. Do you have a moment to take a question or two?
Yes, I will be happy to.
Thank you. So, Erica, would you please queue up the first question, if we have any, from press?
Certainly. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. Again, that is the star and one, and we'll pause just briefly for questions to queue. We'll go first to the side of Pilar Marrero from La Opinion.
Hello, Congressman. How are you? This is Pilar Marrero.
Good.
What assurances have you gotten from Hillary Clinton that she's really going to take this seriously and do something if she wins, as soon as she gets to office?
You know, one of the highlights of my participation within the Hillary Clinton campaign was working with Zoe Loughran to help the former First Lady and Secretary of State fashion a response. And I think if you look at the response, the speaking about it as a hemispheric issue that Hillary has done, talking about that they should all have lawyers, which I know Ayla and others will talk about more as we move forward in this press conference, that all those kids and all those moms should have lawyers. I think that's a very positive response. She said, stop the deportations, right? That is, stop rounding up. We all know who they're rounding up. They're rounding up basically kids that are turning 18 years of age, right, that have lost their cases or through absentia or another fashion didn't make their case in court. That's who they're rounding up, and to stop that, and that we should have a hemispheric. So think on the broad hemispheric. I'm going to continue to encourage the Hillary Clinton campaign to keep stressing these issues. And so I think hemispheric approach, we're there. Everybody's got to have a lawyer, we're there. And Hillary Clinton saying in the interim period, stop these deportations until we could get policies that ensure a response, a hemispheric approach, and that everybody gets a lawyer. I think those are steps in the right direction.
Thank you.
And once again, that is star and one, and we'll go next to Barry Fontenot from Congressman Clay's office.
Hello. I just had a couple of questions. First of all, thanks a lot for coming out and speaking to us. But second, I was wondering, you mentioned at various points a hemispheric approach. Could you just give us a quick rundown of what that would entail?
Yeah, so I think what we do is we bring all our allies together, right? And we say, well, Belize is right next door. What can you do, right? And obviously we also, as we do with Turkey, as we do with Lebanon, as we do with our allies in Jordan, right? You know, we create structures and we contribute. I mean, we're the powerhouse, right, of the hemisphere, but we engage them, right? So Costa Rica's a wonderful dynamic democracy. They're not coming from there. They're not coming from Belize, right? They're not coming from Panama. What can we do? What is Canada ready to do as a member of the Western Hemisphere? We know what Canada is ready and willing to do when it comes to Syrians, right? I mean, the Prime Minister of Canada has been a champion. And so we need to engage him so that he sees that the same way he embraces Syrians in Canada of today, that he looks at Salvadorians and he looks at Hondurans. So it isn't just the United States of America. It's all of us together. And look, I don't have all the answers, but what's Argentina and Chile ready to do? What is Latin America ready to do? And so I think you have an approach so that people can register. And do they need to come all the way to the United States to register for a refugee program? Do they need to come all the way here? Can we register them in their countries? Can we register them and have places for them to safely go to immediately next to Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras? Let's remember, there are already tens of thousands of people. If you cumulatively between the three countries, 250,000 people, it is estimated, that are already displaced internally. They're leaving. They need to find a safe place. And we need to look at this as we look at the Sudan, as we look at issues in the Middle East.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Congressman, tell us if you need to go.
I think I got one more, and then
okay.
We can go.
Great.
Thank
we
you.
Do have one more question in queue. It
sure.
Is from
Thank
Claudia
you.
Claudia Torrens from Associated Press.
Okay.
Hi. Good morning, Congressman. My question is, you mentioned, you said something about Secretary of State Kerry needs to pay attention to this subject. What should he do exactly?
Again, I'm going to repeat what I think he should call a meeting of the member states of the Western Hemisphere and the leading democracies in the Western Hemisphere and see how they can all coordinate, right? I think there should be, can we talk to, I don't know, but he's got to call the meeting. He's got to say, Mexico, what can you do? What can you do to give people a safe place until such time they can travel to a more permanent destination, right? Belize, Costa Rica, what can you do? Canada, what can you do? We know that we need a hemispheric approach. The same way we have coordinated for Syrians to go to Lebanon and to go to Jordan and to go to Turkey, and then hundreds of thousands of them being resettled in Europe. What is the plan in our hemisphere? Look at them as refugees. Do not, as I stated in the beginning, these are not migrants. These are not undocumented workers looking for a new way of, they could live in poverty. They cannot live with the violence. Thank you so much for having me on the call. I really do appreciate it. And thank you to Ayla, my wonderful friends and wonderful champions of our immigrant community. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Congressman, for taking the time. So we are now going to turn it over to our other speakers. First, we're going to go with Daniela Bergi Palomino, who is a senior associate for Mexico Border and Migration with the Latin American Working Group. Latin American Working Group works with organizations in the region that have been affected, so they have quite a bit of on-the-ground expertise. In fact, Daniela herself went to Mexico in January and will be going again in July. Specifically, her trips have been looking at access to asylum in Mexico for Central Americans who are fleeing. With that brief introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Daniela.
Thank you so much, Greg and Ayla and Representative Gutierrez, for hosting this important discussion. It really couldn't come at a more crucial time. I just want to emphasize a few points to add to what Representative Gutierrez already said about why it is that we're talking about refugees. The protection needs of individuals from the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, have been documented by international organizations like the UNHCR since 2014, where in studies they found that over half of, for example, a sample of 400 unaccompanied children had real protection needs and could qualify for refugee protection back then. What we think has changed a little bit now is the sense of the urgency and the intensification of the violence. As Greg said, we at the Latin America Working Group work with partner organizations in Mexico and Central America who have been telling us that the people who used to approach them used to be scared that something was going to happen to them. But now, in the last few months, in the last year, it already has to them and their family members. And 2015, we saw that the region that we're talking about, which is a population of just under 30 million people, about the size of the state of Oregon, had a death toll of 17,500. That's higher than any ongoing armed conflict except Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. The murder rate in El Salvador continues to be high. It began this year in January at 24 homicides per hour per day. It's 24 per day. So it's one per hour per day. And although this figure might fluctuate a little bit due to the sort of agreements that the government might reach with gangs, it continues to be high. We know from past experience it's probably going to pick up even if it dips a little bit. In Honduras, we saw as recent as 2 months ago at the end of March, a neighborhood in Tegucigalpa, the capital, where gangs approached the residents and told them they had 24 hours to pick up their belongings and leave or be killed. And that same incident had happened in another neighborhood that same week. So we're talking about 200 people in just one city that were forced to leave and given hours to leave. I spoke with a partner in El Salvador just yesterday who said that he continues to receive family units of individuals from ranging from 14 to 18 people who are looking for a safe space. Just weeks ago. And I want to unpack the violence that we're talking about here, really, and who's behind it, and what populations specifically are being targeted. We know from our partner organizations that the vast majority of violence is being perpetuated by gangs, followed by drug cartels, and increasingly police and military, who are starting to target gang members or anyone who could potentially be one. And I want to emphasize here that militarized policing, too, is not a solution to targeting civilians or families who might be caught in the crossfire between gangs. We need to focus on the prevention of violence. Who's being targeted? We know that specific populations are being targeted. Going from young men who are being forcibly recruited to join gangs, their girlfriends and families who are also being targeted for extortion taxes or going to be killed if someone doesn't join the gang. Small business owners who are caught between the crossfire of gangs because they cross gang territory on a daily basis. Women and children and LGBTI individuals. And I want to stop here because these are cases that aren't really frequently discussed enough because of the stigma that's attached to rape and sexual assault and the lack of training that law enforcement and migration enforcement officials have all over, really, to deal with these cases. We know when we have heard of cases of women being forced to serve as sexual slaves of gang members, wives of police officers who are being targeted because of what their husband does, kidnapping, high levels of kidnapping and rape, not just by gang members, but also high levels of intrafamilial violence. In El Salvador, we know that last year there was approximately 5 cases of sexual assault per day. In Honduras last year, against women, in Honduras last year, we're talking about 417 women that were murdered in 2015. That amounts to one every 16 hours. And what these women really do not have a recourse to approach police officers or law enforcement officials to deal with their cases. In fact, they fear that because the police could also end up re-victimizing them and telling them that it's their fault, which happens multiple times. 12% of the cases that we saw of violence against women that a civil society organization documented in El Salvador, the perpetrators of 12% of those cases were actually police, lawyers, prosecutors. So women really do not have an option to approach any sort of law enforcement official. And so too many times what we end up seeing, there are hundreds of cases like this that need to be highlighted and shared, is that a woman might have endured, for example, several rapes at the hands of gang members. Probably has her brother or another close family member who has already been killed by the gangs, and perhaps a son or daughter who is increasingly being threatened by gangs and who can no longer go to school and spends their entire day indoors because for fear of what might happen. That woman might initially flee to a family member for safety, but in a country like El Salvador where the territory, about 70% of the territory is controlled by gangs, the likelihood that your family isn't a safe option is probably going to be pretty low. And obviously you can't approach the police, as I already mentioned, because the vast majority, not only are they scared of the police, the vast majority of the cases that we're talking about here remain in impunity, upwards of 80%, which only go higher when you're talking about cases of sexual and gender-based violence. And so the next option really for this woman is to leave her country, to cross Mexico, and to come to the United States. And of course, we can only speak of everything that happens to her while crossing Mexico. We know that a woman who crosses Mexico has about a 60% chance of being raped or sexually assaulted once again. So these are the cases that we continue to hear about. I just want to emphasize two quick anecdotes and then end to show you the levels of desperation and urgency that people are facing in the Northern Triangle countries. Just yesterday, we heard from our partners in Mexico who are sort of at the front lines of receiving Central American migrants when they leave their countries. We heard that another migrants committed suicide in a migrant detention center in the south, southern border of Mexico 1 hour before he was supposed to be deported back to Honduras. This is the fourth sort of suicide that we've seen along Mexico's southern border, and it just speaks to the fear that people have of returning to the very situation that they were escaping, and that, you know, is higher than that they choose to take their life in front of that situation. So just to end, deterrence, detention and enforcement mechanisms really are not working. We've seen from studies that people are aware of the dangers that they're going to face on the journey and that they might face detention and be sent back to their countries once they reach the United States. But that's a risk they're willing to take because of the multiple forms of violence that they face on a daily basis. And then as I explained in my example, how is a woman going to explain that to an asylum officer, going to explain what happened to her, going to explain why her child isn't going to school, when it's really multiple forms of violence that are present and that are there and that qualify her for refugee protection? So we need immediate protection mechanisms, both in country and with the neighboring countries, in Mexico and the United States, that really offer due process and access to asylum for these individuals. And of course, longer-term solutions of the kinds of partnerships that Representative Gutierrez was talking about with Central American governments to address impunity and corruption there as well. So I'll just end on that note, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much, Daniela. So I'm now going to turn it over to Ben Johnson, who is the Executive Director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Ben just started this year as our Executive Director. Previously, he had been serving as the Director for the American Immigration Council, a partner organization of AILA's. Ben has more than 20 years of experience as a lawyer in the immigration field, first representing individuals who are in need of immigration law assistance, and then here in Washington working on policy and all sorts of other issues related to immigration reform. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Ben Johnson.
Thanks, Craig, and thanks, Daniela, for your participation in this. I'll be brief so we can get to questions. I think I just want to underscore that, you know, what you're hearing just in this short conference is that there is overwhelming evidence coming from both domestic and international organizations that the families that have been arriving at our borders from Central America over the last couple of years, at least in larger numbers, are unquestionably refugees. They are fleeing unimaginable violence in their home countries, where El Salvador and Honduras are sort of passing the baton back and forth on which of those countries is the murder capital of the world. Unfortunately, the response from the United States has been completely dominated by a strategy of enforcement and deterrence. What we have seen, instead of a protection-based response, instead of a trauma-informed response, what we have seen is the current administration, the Department of Homeland Security, consistently referring to these families as illegal border crossers, treating them as illegal border crossers, entering them into expedited removal proceedings that puts them immediately into the private prisons that have been stood up in Dilley, Texas, and in Carnes, and trying to move their cases as quickly as possible through a system that is more focused on getting to the end result of removal rather than determining what are the facts in a particular case. Very proud to be part of AILA at this moment because AILA, with its partners, Clinic, the American Immigration Council, and RAISIS, have stood up a project, the CARA project down at in Texas, working to provide some resources and assistance and representation to these families. Literally spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars in volunteer attorney hours trying to restore some due process to this system that we've created and try to ensure that these cases are heard and these women and their children have an opportunity to be heard and to have an opportunity to be represented in court. Unfortunately, the administration has resisted those efforts over and over again. And they have continued, as I said, to treat these as illegal border crossers. That strategy is a failure. It's a failure for many reasons. One, it's wrong as a matter of law. It is simply not against the law to come to the United States and seek asylum. These are not illegal border crossers. These are asylum seekers. Our laws allow for people, and the overwhelming majority of them are turning themselves over, literally turning themselves over to Border Patrol agents. They're not evading capture. They are seeking assistance. So these are not illegal border crossers as a matter of law, and our response is wrong as a matter of law. As others have said, it's completely failed as a policy. We are not going to be able to compete with the kind of violence that these people are fleeing from a deterrence perspective. And it certainly is heart-wrenching to see us even attempt to stand up a system that attempts to be more frightening, more scary, more intimidating than where they came from as a way to encourage them to stay home. That, again, is not only a failed strategy, it completely ignores what we're encouraging them to stay home and endure. It has had just, worst of all, not only is it a failed policy, it is having disastrous consequences. You know, the CARA project today released a document outlining the kinds of abuses and due process violations that we've been seeing for the families that are coming back into detention after being the subject of these targeted raids that the administration has announced. Now, this second wave of raids, the first announced just on Christmas Eve of last year, and again a new resurgent raid that was announced several weeks ago, maybe a month ago now. Every iteration of these raids results in more horrendous examples of mistreatment and abuse, quite frankly. So what we're seeing consistently is problems with, and in some cases, complete lack of notice about the court hearings. We're seeing the failure of these families and of the system to provide them adequate representation. The opportunity to get a lawyer is critical to the outcomes in their cases. The idea that these traumatized families would be able to present their case in immigration court by themselves is that's an untenable situation. And to say that we've given them an opportunity to represent themselves, to say that is due process is a fiction. So that's not happening. Many are being wrongfully arrested before they even had a court hearing. We've seen at least two cases involving families that have been arrested before they even had an opportunity to get in front of the judge. We've seen wrongful deportations of families trying to assert an asylum claim after arrest, but having fast-tracked their removal in a way to short-circuit that effort. And in general, this whole strategy of fast-track removal orders, most of them, or many of them, happening without an opportunity to appear in front of an immigration judge, so the removal order essentially being issued by an immigration agent on the ground rather than an immigration court, are the kinds of abuses that we're seeing. What we need instead of this deterrence and enforcement strategy, as Representative Gutierrez and as Daniela has pointed out, is a regional response. We need to focus on a protection-based strategy, a trauma-informed strategy that seeks the involvement and the cooperation and collaboration of our regional partners in responding to this regional refugee crisis. That's going to be very hard to do if overwhelmingly the signal that we're sending not only to these families but to the region is that we think this is an illegal border crossing problem and that these families need detention and enforcement strategies. You're not going to be able to effectively recruit partners from the region into a trauma-informed, protection-based strategy if we keep leading with enforcement and deterrence. So we are setting ourselves up to fail in terms of creating a trauma-informed, protection-based response. And, you know, what does a protection-based response involve? Again, inclusion of those regions. But it involves for those folks, AILA's particular focus is on the folks that do manage to get their way to the border. We must end the practice of family detention. There is no reason for these families to be locked up in private prisons and denied the opportunity to not only talk to family members, but also to get the kind of assistance that they need to be able to tell their stories. They must be given counsel. AILA has done with our partners, the clinic, Raisis, and the council has done all that we can to provide representation, but more must be done, and the government must be a partner in providing resources and opportunities for representation. And we must then finally end the practice of treating them like illegal border crossers. Stop the practice of expedited removal. Stop the practice of fast-track court hearings that deny these people a meaningful opportunity to be heard. So let me stop there and hope that you all might have some questions that we can help you wrestle with.
Thank you so much, Ben and Daniela, for taking the time to describe the situation in more detail. In a moment, we're going to open it up to any questions that the press may have. I also want to mention that even though Congressman Gutierrez dropped off the call, if there are follow-up questions that any of you have, please direct them to Doug Rivlin, who is their Director of Communications for the Congressman, and our communications team can supply that contact information if you don't have it. One last thing I just want to mention, as Ben was describing the cases of the families that we have seen through the CARA Family Detention Project of families picked up in the raid and other enforcement actions in recent weeks, we have also issued through the CARA project an update with information about the families that have been picked up now that we have been able to identify through these arrest actions. It's more than 40 individuals that we are now assisting in that process that form the basis of what Ben was describing in terms of the due process violations and the compelling asylum cases they have. You should have gotten an email already with that information, but contact our press team if you don't already have that. With that, moderator or call coordinator Erica, would you please queue up the first questions we have? Thank you.
Certainly, and just as a reminder, it is star and one if you'd like to ask a question. And we'll go to a Barry Fontenot from Congressman Clay's office.
Thank you. I just had one quick question. What would a policy-based solution to this problem look like? What sort of things can I recommend to the congressman that might help?
Well, it'd be a protection-based solution is what I was trying to describe. If I misspoke, I'm sorry about that. But protection-based solution, I think Daniela is probably a better expert on this than I am. But it is one that is built on a foundational understanding that these are refugees fleeing violence. We have a lot of experience doing that in other places in the world, but I think, quite frankly, we have a bias towards the Western Hemisphere and perhaps a bias towards the kind of violence that these women and children and others are facing there, and that's, I think, part of the struggle in applying what we know and have done in other regions of the world to this part of the world. But Daniela, I think you're a better voice on what a protection-based strategy would look like.
Well, I think Ben's spoken to a couple of the issues with detention and the need for due process and access to asylum here in the U.S. But regionally, we would like to see Mexico's national asylum system strengthened and less attention paid to border enforcement. There are some steps that have been taken by the administration, for example, the Central American Minors In-Country Processing Program, which offers an opportunity for minors and children in the region to apply for asylum, but only those who have parents of legal status in the United States. And unfortunately, we've seen multiple delays with that program where children have had to wait months to hear about the decision. So, and once, as I was saying, these are immediate and urgent mechanisms, so expedited removals in these cases. And then, unfortunately, we haven't heard any further progress on the administration's plans to roll out a third country refugee resettlement program in the rest of the region that could potentially also help alleviate and provide access to protection for some of these individuals.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for that, Danielle. I just want to underscore, I should have taken that opportunity to say that, yeah, there are regional responses that involve, you know, external practices and policies that we can put in place. But Danielle is exactly right. As I said, we have to stop, you know, for those who get here, we have to stop treating them as illegal border crossers. Ending family detention, providing access to lawyers, providing them information about their rights and their responsibilities so that they have a meaningful chance to navigate the system. I mean, nobody wants these families to be uninformed and unaware of their rights and their responsibilities. You know, we need these families to know that they've got to get their, you know, meet their court dates, get in front of these judges. And overwhelmingly, when we provide them assistance and guidance and information, they meet those obligations. When we leave them to fend for themselves, they are often completely without the resources or understanding of what to do next, and that is the worst of all possible situations.
This is Greg Chen. Just one statistic to share. Annually, the U.S. State Department sets a goal that functions almost as, essentially as a ceiling of the number of refugees to be resettled from other countries here to the United States that the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program sets into place. Annually, the number for those coming from the entire Latin American region has been 4,000. They increased it last year, I believe, to about 5,000. Danielle knows this probably better than I do. But for other regions of the in the world, it typically is 15,000 to 25,000 for other regions. So the Latin American region has been it does not tend to be seen as a refugee region, and that's the shift that needs to happen now that hasn't happened yet. Erica, next question.
Yes, we'll go next to the site of Julie Contreras from NULAC of Lake County.
Yes, hi, that's LULAC of Lake County. Here in the Midwest, we have the Child Refugees United for Freedom campaign, and my question is to Ben Johnson. As you discussed, giving them the sense of they are refugees, they are not crossing in an illegal format. What I am experiencing here now with numerous numbers of women that are being trapped in abnormal-like conditions with these ankle monitors. In recent months, I had a El Salvadorian refugee whose leg was completely shattered, the ankle. She now has plates, metal plates in there. My question to you is, what would AILA or other legal agencies, I mean, LULAC here on the base, we are advocating for them. I have a group of 20 women that just want to cut that ankle bracelet off because one of them last week had her leg the size of a football, and you had agents that are being contracted in this private facility that's monitoring them, telling her it had nothing to do with her health and that the swelling would go down. This is barbaric. This is unacceptable. What is your solution to the current crisis of these females being treated like criminals with this ankle monitoring? They cannot leave their home, the facility in which they go in to be monitored a whole day. There's no bathroom access, and their children are not allowed to be fed, and the children are What is your solution and an immediate solution to assist these women that are being treated in this inhumane mannerism?
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing those issues and examples to the forefront here. Look, we need a top-to-bottom change in how we're responding to this situation. We need, again, a protection-based, trauma-informed strategy would be one where we're providing these women and their children, these refugees, with access to resources, to welcoming centers that will help them understand what are their rights and what are their responsibilities. There are many, many NGOs. I'm sure LULAC is one of them. Certainly AILA has been trying to stand up pro bono efforts, Clinic, Raices, Lutheran Immigration Refugee Services, lots of organizations that are prepared to work in partnership with the government to create informational strategies that are about understanding what happened to these families, helping to determine that the facts of these particular cases and get them presented, and end the assumption and the ongoing practice of treating them as if they are a threat to public safety, as if they are a threat to border security, that we can, should, and are able to make those kinds of determinations without aggressive, inhumane strategies like detention and ankle shackles and those kinds of things. So I think we need a complete review of that. Unfortunately, I mean, the government in some way must understand that, but unfortunately what they did, rather than contracting with NGOs who know how to provide this kind of guidance and assistance, they've contracted with GeoCares, which is an offshoot of the same private prison company that is running the private prison detention facility down in Texas. So they're simply just passing the family to yet another enforcement-driven agency with no sense of how to prioritize the provision of information and resources and assistance. So we need to completely undo what we've been doing and do it with the fundamental understanding that these are refugees.
Thank you.
And once again, that is the star and one if you'd like to ask a question. We'll go next to the site of Sony Sanga from Fox News Latino.
Hi. I have a question about what happens to people who have been in a detention facility after they pass the credible fear interview. I know that you alluded to a couple of people who whose cases kind of got fast-tracked, but I wonder, is that getting to be more common, or is it common where their asylum claim and then their appearance in court kind of diverge and are not happening simultaneously, or that somehow the asylum claim gets lost?
Well, I mean, again, overwhelmingly, what we see is when we get an opportunity to present a credible fear interview, quite frankly, that's something that shouldn't be happening. That credible fear interview is an element of the expedited removal process, and we think the expedited removal process should end. We've seen plenty of evidence already. The fact that 90% of the people are passing a credible fear interview, that the agency itself is recognizing that they have a credible fear and a legitimate claim to asylum, that indicates that, again, overwhelmingly these are cases that should move into the court phase and out of detention phase. Once they get a positive credible fear finding, oftentimes, the majority of cases, we are eventually able to get them out of custody, but it's, sometimes it's with a very high bond. Sometimes it's with these ankle bracelets that the woman from LULAC mentioned before. So, I mean, the agency has continued to be very aggressive about imposing requirements, release requirements that are much more akin to border crossers, illegal border crossers, than to asylum seekers. So, and once they are out of custody, though, they are continued to be fast-tracked because we have not invested in a court system that has adequate judges to review these cases. Oftentimes, when people are released from custody, it'll be years before their cases appear before an immigration judge. So for these families, in order to have the deterrent effect that the administration is looking for, they have prioritized these cases and moved them ahead of all of the other cases that are in line to get a hearing in front of an immigration judge. So these cases are moving much faster than any other cases in the immigration court system, which, is obvious a problem because, it speaks to their willingness to really move these cases to the front of the line, even ahead of people or cases where you might legitimately say from a law enforcement perspective that this is a case that ought to be prioritized from a law enforcement perspective instead of these women and children. But again, they are so fixated on the deterrence message that they're moving these cases through the court system as fast as they can. But an essential component not only of dealing with these cases but with all immigration cases is to understand that we do not have enough judges to deal with the caseload with the billions of dollars that we spend on immigration enforcement and the numbers of people that are being put into removal proceedings, we have completely ignored the fact that you've got to have judges processing these cases. I encourage you to talk to or read the materials from the National Association of Immigration Judges. They describe a workload for immigration judges that is crushing and is completely at odds with the idea of them being able to make legitimate adjudications of these cases. So we need reforms of the immigration court system, and certainly these families deserve a full opportunity to be heard in front of immigration judges.
Thank you. We'll go next to the site of Pilar Marrero from Law Opinion. Please go ahead.
Hi. I see that these new waves of raids happen especially in specific states, like North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Texas. Why is that? Is there a reason for that?
The administration isn't indicating why they would have picked those regions. I suspect the reason that they picked those regions, or reason that we're seeing people from those regions, is those are regions where you have incredibly low asylum approval rates. So those are places where where asylum claims are routinely denied. So these are the places where you're likely to see removal orders being issued, even if they had an opportunity to appear before a judge. So I suspect that that's the fact that these are coming from areas where there is a real challenge about representation, not enough lawyers or certified representatives in those regions, not enough places for them to go for help, and too many judges who simply deny all asylum claims. That is the kind of environment where you're going to end up seeing more removal orders, and that's probably why we're seeing them from there.
This is Greg Chen. Just to reference the report that we issued, Due Process Denied, that came out today from AILA, there's a section on the immigration court asylum grant rate that gives exactly the statistics that Ben just mentioned. In 2014, the national average asylum grant rate was 43%. But immigration judges in several of the jurisdictions, particularly the ones that where these raids have been happening, are far lower than that. So in Atlanta, Georgia, and in the Stewart Detention Facility in Georgia, it's 2% and 5% respectively is the grant rate for asylum in those courts for all asylum cases, not just families or anything like that, all asylum cases. In several Texas regions, the range is 4% up to about 14%. In Charlotte, North Carolina, it's 13%. So all these areas, which is where the raids have been concentrated, are far, far below the 43% national average in 2014.
Okay, thank you.
Next question, Erica.
Yes, we'll go next to the site of Ivan Roman from Noticel. Please go ahead.
Hello, hi. In the first wave of detention, there were some problems that were pointed out regarding the manner in which the raids were being conducted. You had local police, Border Patrol people posing as local police and basically deceiving people getting into their homes and different kinds of practices of that manner. And I don't recall the details, but apparently there was some court decision that pointed out some of these concerns. I was wondering if you saw or noticed in the second wave of detention if the raids are being done differently, or if they've improved the way they're doing them, or if they're just continuing the abuse of the second wave that we see.
Yeah, I, the reports that we're getting are that they are continuing to use deceptive practices to gain access to people's homes in order to make an arrest. And they are also violating their current policies regarding, sensitive areas. I think the case examples from the CARA project include examples of one woman who was arrested while she was you know, on the way, taking her child to school, waiting for the school bus to arrive, and they waited until the child got on the bus, arrested the mother, and then called the child off of the bus in front of all of his school friends. We see, you know, lots of more abusive behaviors, or the same kinds of abusive behaviors as we saw really the first time around. And in this CARA update that Greg mentioned that has been sent around, that there are case examples of aggressive ICE tactics in the communities and threatening and abusive behavior.
Okay, thank you. And at this time, if you'd like to ask a question again, it is the star and one on your touchtone phone. We'll pause for any further questions to queue. It does not appear we have any further questions at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you, Erica, for moderating this for us and the call. Thank you in particular to the speakers, Ben Johnson, Daniela Berge-Palomina from Latin American Working Group, and, of course, Congressman Gutierrez. Please feel free to follow up with Bell Woods or George Tamaris, our press team, if you have further questions and follow-ups direct to the speakers. Thank you for joining the call today. And this concludes our call.